Marty said. He turned toward the stereo cabinet and pressed the magnetic catch. The glass door sprang open half an inch. Harper shut her eyes and thought, despair is no more than a synonym for consciousness. No power, asshole, said the Marlboro man. A Porsche is just a half ton of worthless iron if there's no gas in the tank. Ah, fuck. Good point, Marlboro man. I wasn't thinking. He pushed the cabinet door shut without looking in. There's some breaking news. Neither of them spoke for a few moments. She heard the gurgle of whiskey splashing into the glass, swallowing, and reverential sighs. When Marty spoke again, his voice was pitched low. He's kind of scary, don't you think? Who? Public Works? Yeah, Jacob, with that burn on his neck, that black hand cooked right in the skin, and his eyes, you know, like dusty old glass, like doll's eyes. Listen to you. You're practically Lord Byron with the similes. Tell you what, I think he'd rather find the fireman here than his wife. I think he's got a bigger hard-on for him than he does for the runaway bride. There ain't no fireman. There was an uneasy silence. Well, Marty said, Marlboro man, someone burned his neck. And the other night, 80 guys saw the devil, 2 stories high, down by the police station. 80 guys! And Arlo Granger in the fire department, he wrestled with some dude in the smoke. Some dude with a British accent, dressed up in a fire helmet and everything. Arlo would have kicked his head in, except the fireman had friends, like 5 friends, and they ganged up on him. I know Arlo Granger, and that guy is a fucking liar. He told me once that he got backstage at a Rush concert and snorted coke with Neil Peart. I wish the guys in Rush snorted coke. Maybe it would amp them up and they'd try playing some real rock and roll for once, instead of that limp dick prog rock bullshit. My cousin is in the National Guard. Amy Castigan. You've hung out with Amy. Amy. Your cousin Amy. Maybe. Yeah, I think she sucked my dick once. Yeah, me too, but listen, Marlboro man. Amy was manning the checkpoint on the Piscataqua Bridge back in September, middle of the night, and she sees this red blaze coming up the river, like someone shot a rocket at them. Her and the other guys hit the deck, and just in time, too. This giant fucking bird of flame, 30 feet from wingtip to wingtip, dive-bombed them. It dived so close the sandbags caught fire. And while Amy and the guys in her unit were ducking for cover, a car ran the checkpoint and some burners escaped into Maine. That was him, too. That's what he does. He's figured out how to weaponize Dragon Scale Man. That's one possibility, the Marlboro man said. The other possibility is your cousin is the biggest fucking hoe bag on the East Coast, and someone ran the checkpoint while she was treating her entire unit to the Amy Castigan blowjob special. There ain't no fireman. And Satan didn't turn up at the police department last night. People see things in flame, freaky faces and stuff, that's all. Harper thought inevitably of the girl in John's furnace. Sarah's story, she was sure. The Marlboro man could believe what he liked, but sometimes the face in the fire really was someone looking back at you. Boards and plaster sheeting slid and thumped in the stairwell. Nothing, Jacob said. Nothing and no one. I told you. If someone had been here, there'd be tracks. She's 6 months pregnant. I doubt she can go 100 paces without running out of breath. That's a fair point, Squire, said the Marlboro man. My ex, when she was pregnant, if she wanted anything, cigarettes, beer, ice cream, anything, she'd make me get it, even if it was only in the next room. Sorry the psychic flash didn't work out, but at least you found the Balvenie. We can take it with us. That's $500 a bottle, so drink it slow. What's the hurry? Have a couple of drinks and I'll polish you off in a game of pool. I'll need more than a couple before that would happen, Jacob said. Want a wager on it? With what? Money isn't what it used to be. I win. You have to go upstairs and find me a pair of your wife's panties, said the Marlboro man. If I win, you have to wear them, Jacob said. Hey, what if I win? Marty asked. What if you invent a cure for fucking Dragon Scale? What if you didn't laugh like a 13-year-old girl with the hiccups? Marty laughed like a 13-year-old girl with the hiccups. "Who breaks?" Jacob said. There was a loud crack as one ball struck a dozen. "Is this single elimination?" Marty asked. "Or best of three?" "Whatever," said the Marlboro man. "I don't have any place to be." 6. A powdery snow granulated the night. She drifted through a frozen darkness, her nostrils stinging from the cold. The light had been failing when she entered her house. Now, 6 games of pool later, it was who knew when, 9, 10, and her legs were cramped from the hours she had spent balled up in the covered space behind the tinted glass door. Jacob had been better at pool, but the Marlboro man was superior at holding his drink. The fat man, from his voice alone, Harper felt sure he was at least 300 pounds, had left with a pair of her undies in his coat pocket, whistling centerfold. She waited at least 30 minutes to crawl out of her hiding place, half believing Jacob and his new friends would still be there, silently waiting for her. They had left the empty bottle of Balvenie upside down in one of the side pockets. She should have been wretched, choking on sobs, or quaking helplessly in shock. Instead, Harper felt buzzed, as if she had just skied a slope at the very edge of her ability, taking turns faster than she had ever taken them before. She had heard of adrenaline highs, but wasn't sure if she had ever had one before. She was hardly aware of her legs carrying her forward. Harper didn't know where she was going until she got there. She wandered right past the entrance to Camp Wyndham, past the chain hung between the stone monoliths, past the burned-out wreckage of the bus, and followed Little Harbor Lane until it switched to gravel. In another 100 feet, it turned into a boat ramp, angling down into the lapping foam of the Atlantic. And there was the Fireman's Island. A quick clamber over a stone breakwater, a 2-minute walk along the shingle, and she came in sight of Camp Wyndham's dock. She had promised Allie she would be back in 2 hours. It had been maybe twice that. Harper dreaded facing Allie, who was likely in trouble by now, and who almost certainly had spent the evening sick with worry. Harper decided solemnly to do whatever was necessary to make amends. But Allie would have to worry a little longer. Harper had left John Rookwood on his island all alone for 3 days, with smashed ribs, a sprained elbow, and a wrist that had been seriously dislocated. He was her whole reason for slipping out of the infirmary. It would be a poor joke to head back without seeing him. Besides, for all Allie's talk about how they were going to start making examples out of people who broke the rules, Harper couldn't take any of it too seriously. To Harper, it was elementary school all over again. There were rules, of course, and consequences for breaking them. But rules and consequences alike were applied by the grown-ups to the kids, and Harper was a grown-up. A student might get a demerit slip for running in the hall, but if someone on staff broke into a jog, presumably they had a good reason. Ben might be annoyed with her, but she would talk to him and smooth everything over. She was no more threatened by his authority, or Carol's, than she would have felt threatened by a teacher. It was not, after all, like anyone was going to make her write, "I will not leave camp without a permission slip," 100 times on the chalkboard. She rode across a heaving liquid darkness. She felt a kind of slow tidal rocking inside her as well, as if she herself contained a smaller sea. Harper knocked on the doorframe of the fireman's shed. "Who's that, then?"
"Harper."
"Ah, finally. I warn you, I'm not dressed. I'll give you a minute." She took a deep breath of damp, salted, frozen air, let it out in a trickle of white fog. She had never looked around his island, not really, and tramped up the great central dune to see the view from the highest point. It wasn't much of a rock, a couple acres long, shaped like an eye. One central ridge ran along the island lengthwise, with the fireman's little shed built into one side of it. At the southern tip was the ruin of a guest house, a collapsed rectangle of carbonized beams poking out of a layer of snow no deeper than a bedsheet. She was momentarily surprised by the sight of the boat. It stood just above the pebbly shingle on the eastern face of the island, a 35-foot-long sailboat resting in a stainless steel carriage, the deck covered by a taut white tarp. But then Father Story had mentioned a boat out here, had talked about taking it on a search for Martha Quinn. If the snow kept falling, soon it would just look like a part of the landscape, one vast white dune to tower over the others. The cold was making her cheeks numb. She tracked back down the sand and let herself into the fireman's shed without knocking. She came in, stamping her boots and rubbing her hands, shaking off snow. "Willows! I've never been so glad to see another human face. It feels like a car is parked on my chest. I haven't been in so much pain since Guns N' Roses broke up." "Sorry," she said. She dropped the cloth shopping bag she had brought with her. "Busy day." She opened her mouth to tell him about Jacob and the Marlboro Man and almost being discovered, then caught herself. He was sitting on his cot, and he still wasn't wearing a stitch, except for the sling she had made out of a canvas quiver. His only gesture to modesty was the bedsheet bunched up in his lap and pooled around his hips. His skin was scrawled all over with the devil's handwriting in black and gold. The bruises beneath the scale had darkened to shades of blackberry and pomegranate. It hurt her in her own chest just to look at them. "You still aren't dressed," she said. "Well," he said, "I wasn't sure I should bother. Aren't you going to examine me? Seemed a lot of effort to go to just to take it all off again. And where have you been? I've been stranded on this muddy blob of sand for days, with no one to talk to but myself. At least you were having conversations with someone who thinks you're clever." He fixed the cloth shopping bag with a rapacious glare. "There better be morphine in there, and cigarettes, and fresh ground coffee. I wish I had morphine. In fact, we'll have to talk about that." "Cigarettes?" "I don't have any cigarettes for you right this instant, Mr. Rookwood," she said, choosing her words with care. This was not a lie, but it was also not strictly honest. Harper was becoming practiced at such evasions. "Look at it as an opportunity to quit before the smokes kill you." "You think smoking is going to kill me? When I smoke, Nurse Willows, it's other people who need to worry about their health. There better be fresh coffee, then." "I brought you some wonderful loose teas." "Tea? You think I want tea?" "Why not? You're English. And so you think I drink tea? What? Do you imagine I used to wander around in the London fog in a deerstalker cap, talking to my mates in iambic pentameter? We have Starbucks, woman." "Oh, good. Because I also have a few packets of Starbucks instant." "Why didn't you say so?" "Because you're such an amusing man to disappoint. How about I put on the kettle and you at least put on some pants? I don't recall any below-the-waist injuries that require a medical opinion." He swept a foggy gaze around the floor, reached with one bony foot for his fireman pants. She took a deep breath to tell him about going home, and then sidetracked herself again, saying, "Did you always want to be a fireman? How long have you been dressing like one? Since childhood?" That was the adrenaline talking. She wondered if this was how people felt after skydiving. Her hands had a tremor. "Not at all. I wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to wear leather pants and spend weekends in bed with stone fashion models and write songs full of pretentious riddles." "I didn't know you were musical. What instrument did you play?" "Oh, I never got around to learning an instrument. Seemed like too much work. Also, as my mother was deaf and my father a bully, musical education wasn't a priority in my family. The closest I ever got to the rock star life was selling drugs." "You were a drug dealer." "I don't think I like that." "What drugs?" "Hallucinogenic mushrooms. Seemed a sensible way to turn a profit on my degree in biology. Mycology had always been my field of study. I sold a form of psilocybin called Smurf Pecker that was quite blue, quite popular, and quite delicious with eggs. Do you want to split a Smurf Pecker omelette with me sometime, Nurse Willows?" She turned her back on him to give him privacy so he could pull on his pants. "The dragon scale, that's a kind of spore, a fungus. You must know a lot about it." He didn't reply. She glanced back and his face was composed into a look of benign innocence. He wasn't even trying to pick up his pants. They were still snarled around his feet. It irritated her that he wouldn't get dressed. It made him more of a creep than she had hoped he would be. She looked away once more. "Is that why you can control it? Use it? Keep from burning alive like you're coated in asbestos? Is it because you understand something about it other people don't understand?" He made a soft humming sound and said, I'm not sure I understand the scale so much as I've helped it to understand me. The pans are in the box under the furnace. Why do I need a pan? Aren't you going to make us eggs? You have eggs? No, don't you? In that grocery bag of yours? For God's sake, Nurse Willows, you must have brought me some goodies. I am sorry to say I did not bring you eggs, or French roast, or morphine. Instead, I hiked 3 miles and nearly walked right into a cremation crew to get a brace for your elbow and tape for your wrist, my ex-husband among them. She felt an unexpected prickle in the back of her eyes that she refused to let become anything more. I also brought you some great loose tea, because I'm nice, and I thought it would cheer you up, and I haven't even asked for thanks. All I've asked is for you to put on your pants, but you won't even do that, because I assume you get off on being naked and seeing if it rattles me. I can't. Can't what? Can't say thanks? Can't apologize? Can't show basic human courtesy? I can't put on my pants. I can't bend over and pick them up. It hurts too much. And you've been very kind, and of course I should have said thanks. I'm saying it now. Thank you, Nurse Willows. The contrition in his voice deflated her in some way. She was coming down off her adrenaline buzz now, a tide receding to reveal the fatigue beneath. I'm sorry. It has been a long couple of days, and I just got through the worst part of it. I went back home to salvage some supplies, and Jacob turned up, with a crowd of new friends. One of them was that bully on the radio, the Marlboro man, the one who's always bragging about all the burners he's executed. I had to hide for a long time. You went home? Alone? Why didn't you send someone? Who? The lookouts are all kids. Starved, overtired kids. I didn't feel like putting one of them at risk. I couldn't send you, not with your ribs like they are. Besides, I know where to look for the things I wanted. It just seemed to make more sense to go myself. You didn't tell me what happened to my house. That your ex decided to remodel with a 2-ton snowplow. I felt like you had lost enough for 1 week. Why pile on? Are you all right? I was scared. I heard them talking about me. They talked about you, too. You don't say, he said. He sounded pleased. Yes, they talked about a man with weaponized dragon scale, someone who can throw flame and who goes around dressed as a fireman. They couldn't decide if you were real or an urban legend. Ah, halfway to being a rock star at last. Mostly they talked about things they've done to people who are sick. The Marlboro man keeps track of the numbers for the whole cremation crew. Was talking about who's killed the most overall, who's murdered the most in one day, who killed the ugliest girl, who killed the hottest girl. It was like he was talking about the stats for his fantasy baseball team. The Marlboro man had praised Jacob for busting his nut on New Year's Day. It was several minutes before Harper realized the Marlboro man was not talking about sex, but murder. Jacob had used his freightliner to T-bone a Nissan with a sick family in it. A man, a woman, and their 2 children. The car had been pancaked. The bodies came squeezing out of the wreckage like toothpaste, or so the Marlboro man said. Jacob had accepted the Marlboro man's praise without comment, expressing neither pride nor horror. What a curious thing, to think the man she had married, a man she had loved and been devoted to, had gone on to commit murders, had killed and meant to kill again. 18 months ago, they had spent their nights cuddled on the couch, watching Master of None. I was scared I'd start shaking and they'd hear me. They'd hear my teeth chattering. Then they left, and when I knew I was okay, that I was going to leave the house alive, I felt like someone threw a grenade at me, and then for some reason it didn't explode. I walked out of there with my head full of cotton fluff and my legs all rubber. Aren't you going to give me a talking to? For being an idiot and blithely walking right into trouble? Yes. Nah. I can't think of 2 qualities I admire more in a person. Glad you came back, though. I haven't had coffee in days. When she turned around, the fireman was yawning, a fist covering his mouth and his eyes squeezed shut, and the sheet had dropped to show the line of his hip. Harper was surprised by her own reaction to the sight of his scrawny, hairy self, the dense pelt of hair on his sunken and battered chest. She felt an immediate twitch of physical want, florid and absurd, where there had been none a minute before. She marched to the bed, feeling there was safety and briskness. "Raise your legs." He lifted his feet. She tugged his fireman pants up to the knees, then sat down beside him and slipped an arm under his armpits. "On three, lift your skinny ass." But she did most of the lifting, and when she scooped him up, she heard it. The whistling inhalation, the shuddering start of a gasp, quickly bitten off. What little color was in his face drained away. "The worst bit isn't the pain when I move. It's the itch in my chest. After every breath, can't sleep the way it itches." "Itch is good. We like itch, Mr. Rookwood. Bones itch when they're knitting back together. I suppose it will feel better after you tape up my chest." No, I'm sorry. That isn't done anymore. We don't want to constrict lungs that need to breathe. But I would like to strap up that wrist of yours and slip this brace on your elbow." She inched the elastic brace up his forearm, shifted it into place, then went to work on his swollen, hideously bruised wrist. Harper pressed cotton pads to either side of the wrist, then wound medical tape around and around, up the wrist and down it, creating an almost stiff but comfortable cast around the joint. After, she lifted the right arm for a look at his discolored side. Harper traced her fingers over his ribs, carefully seeking out each fracture. She tried not to take any pleasure at all in the knuckles of his spine or the scrollwork of dragon scale on his skin. He looked like an illustrated man from a carnival. There was no guessing how many people the dragon scale had killed, but for all that, she could not help thinking it was very beautiful. Of course, she was desperately horny. That didn't help. "You might be in for worse than a tongue-lashing from Ben Patchett," the fireman said. "And you might receive a very unhappy look and some great sad sighs from Tom Story. Nothing makes a person feel more low and ashamed than disappointing the old man. It's like telling a department store Santa you know his beard is fake. I don't think I'll be in trouble with Father Story." He gave her a sharp, searching look, and all the humor dropped from his expression. "Better let me have it, then." She told him about trepanning Father Story's skull with a power drill and disinfecting it with port. She told him about Ben in the meat locker and the handcuffed prisoners and the dish towel full of rocks. Then she had to go back in time to tell him about her last talk with Father Story in the canoe. The fireman did not ask many questions, not until she recounted her final conversation with the old man. He was going to exile some poor girl for stealing a teacup and cans of Spam. And a locket, and the portable mother. He shook his head. "Still, that doesn't seem like Tom." He wasn't going to exile her because she stole. He was going to exile her because she was dangerous. And he knew this because he had confronted her over her thefts and she, what, threatened him? "Something like that," Harper said. But she frowned. It was hard to remember now precisely what Tom had said and how he had said it. It seemed like a conversation that had happened months, not days ago. She found it maddeningly difficult to recall what he had told her about the thief. There were moments when it seemed to her he had never mentioned theft at all. And for some reason he decided he needed to go into exile with this thief. To look after her, he was going to search for Martha Quinn's island. Ah, Martha Quinn's island. I like to imagine it's crowded with refugees from the 80s, wandering about in spandex and leopard fur. I hope Tawny Catane is there. She was at the center of all my earliest sexual fantasies. Who was Tom going to leave in charge of camp? You. Me? He laughed. Are you sure he didn't say all this after getting conked in the head? I can't imagine anyone worse for the job. How about Carol? He had been smiling, but at this his look became unhappy again. I like Carol for High Holy Priest about as much as I'd like another kick in the ribs. You don't think she means well? I'm certain she means well. When your government was waterboarding poor sods to find Bin Laden, they meant well. Carol's father was a moderating influence on her, a calming force on a brittle personality. Without him, well... Carol has quarantine patrols, the police, and cremation crews threatening her from the outside. She has the thief and those two prisoners to create pressure from the inside. Fear does not incline people to be moderate in their use of extreme tactics, especially not people like Carol. I don't know. She didn't even want the job. She turned it down 3 times before she accepted. So did Caesar. I only wish Sarah... He broke off and cast a frustrated look toward the furnace. Then he dropped his gaze and tried again. It's not that Sarah would have kept Carol in check, or tried to wrest the camp from her, or any of that. But she would have tried to throw her little sister a line if she saw her drowning. That's what I'm worried about, you know. Bad enough that Carol might drown in her own paranoia, but what's worse is that drowning victims will pull others down with them. And right now she has her arms around the entire camp. A knot snapped in the furnace with a dry, roasted crack. What was Sarah like? Not like Carol, I guess. More like Tom? She had Tom's sense of humor. She also had more steel than anyone I've ever met. She threw herself at things like a bowling ball. You see some of that in Allie, you know. Sarah always made me feel like one of the tenpins. He cast a long, slow, considering look at the flames leaping in the furnace. Then turned his head and gave Harper a sweet, almost boyish smile. Which I guess is a fairly accurate description of a certain kind of love, isn't it? 7. What is there to say about Sarah before she met me? Pregnant at 17 by her piano instructor, an angelically beautiful Lithuanian only a few years older than her. Cast out of the private academy where her father was a professor. Tom, her best friend in the entire world, and the most forgiving man she knows, says terrible things to her and sends her off to live with relatives. Finishes her senior year in disgrace at a public high school, baby bump under her sweaters. She gets married in a town office the day after she accepts her diploma. Her Lithuanian, humiliated and unable to get a job teaching, returns to private lessons, which is when Sarah discovers that screwing his students is one of his nervous tics. No matter. She stays married because if she left him, she'd have to go home. And she's promised herself she'll never ask her father for another single thing in her life. Instead, she decides the only way to save the relationship is to have another baby. Am I going too quickly? I promise we'll get to the interesting part in a moment. Which part is that? Harper asked. The part where I come into the story. Nick is born. Nick is deaf. The father suggests putting him up for adoption, since he can never have a relationship with a defective brat who can't appreciate his music. Sarah suggests her husband find a new place to live and throws him out. He kicks through the screen door at 4 a.m. one October night and threatens the whole family with a badminton racket. Sarah has a restraining order leveled against him. He responds by showing up at Allie's elementary school, supposedly to take his daughter to a dental appointment, and promptly disappears with the kid. Jesus. He was arrested 4 long days later, in a motel along the Canadian border, where he was trying to figure out how to reach Toronto without a passport for his daughter. I gather he had notions of getting to the Lithuanian embassy and trying to scuttle back to Europe with her. He was out on bail when he hung himself. Sounds like Sarah and me both picked our husbands out in the same shop, Harper said. There was one good thing to come out of the piano tutor's last waltz. In those terrible days when Sarah didn't know where Allie was, her father showed up on her doorstep to do what he could for her. He made sure Sarah ate and slept, held her when she cried, saw to Nick's needs. It was his chance, you see, to be the father she wanted, the father Sarah had believed he was before he so completely, colossally failed her. I know Tom, and I doubt he ever completely forgave himself for turning away from her when she was a frightened, pregnant kid. Tom stayed with her for months. Later, Sarah moved closer to home, and he helped with the kids while she returned to school to study social work. Outreach to the disabled, that was her field. Now, as it happens, Tom's story had supervised worship at Camp Wyndham since the 1980s, and was made camp director a decade later. The spring that Nick turned 7, Sarah suggested the camp host a 2-week program for the deaf, and Tom made it happen. They went looking for counselors who knew how to sign, and I fit the bill. I learned sign language as a lad from my deaf Irish mother, which, I add, charmed quite a few of the kids, who liked to say my hands had an Irish accent. I was in the States to collect a master's degree, and was glad to get a decent-paying summer job. A man just can't earn a living wage selling Smurf pecker in this blighted nation. I have to tell you, heroin dealers and meth slingers have made your country a wretched place to be a simple, honest drug dealer who wants to give his customers a lovingly curated experience. Tom hired me to teach outdoorsy stuff. What berries you could eat, what leaves not to wipe with, how to make fire without matches. I was always especially good at that last trick. On arrival, we were each assigned a cute name. I was dubbed Woody John. Sarah got to be Ranger Sarah. We had a few days of orientation and training before the kids arrived, and I wasn't there long before I could see being named Woody was going to be a problem. On the very first day, Sarah greeted me by saying, "Morning, Wood," with a darling look of sweet innocence on her face. The other counselors heard her and fell all over the place laughing. Pretty soon everyone was saying it. "Who's got Wood? Hey, guys, don't be so hard on Wood. I've been walking around all morning with Wood." You get the idea. Well, the night before the kids were due to show up, we were all having some beers together. And I told her maybe one day, if she was lucky and played her cards right, she might wake up with Wood. That got some laughs. She said it would be more like waking up with a splinter in an awkward place, and that got more. I asked her how come she got to be Ranger Sarah, and she said since she was a program director, she was allowed to pick her own name. So I announced by ancient English law I had the right to challenge her authority with trial by combat. I told her we'd settle it on the dartboard. We'd each get one throw. If I hit closest to the center, I could rename both her and myself. And I warned her ahead of time that I would be choosing Bushmaster for me and the Camp Beaver for her. She said I was going to lose, and she'd let me know my new name after the game, and that soon enough I'd be longing for the days when I was playing old Woody. By now everyone was deadly serious, and by deadly serious I mean crying on the ground. Of course I liked my odds. When I was an undergrad, I spent more time in pubs throwing darts than I did in classrooms taking notes. I stood well back and nearly hit bullseye without so much as a warm-up. Suddenly everyone went completely silent, awestruck by my powers. Sarah didn't so much as blink. She pulled this little hatchet out of her belt, walked to the line, and chucked it. She didn't just hit bullseye. She split the board in half. She told me, "You never said I had to throw a dart." Well, that was how I became Tosser John, on account of how well I could toss a dart. And I suppose that's where it started, the feeling like we belonged together. At the time camp officially got going, Allie and her mother were hardly speaking. Allie, who was all of 14, had been dropped by her third therapist after throwing a paperweight at his balls. She had wrecked her mother's car after taking some boys for a spin in it. Older boys. I couldn't tell you how much of her behavior was a result of being kidnapped by a parent when she was in third grade, but certainly her anger went well beyond the ordinary teenage stuff. She hated her mother for exerting any control over her at all, and was furious she'd been forced to work as a counselor in training. Those first few days were ugly. Allie would wander away from the kids to do things with her cell phone. If she didn't like what they were serving in the cafeteria, she'd walk out of camp and hitch a ride into town to meet up with friends. And so on. Sarah decided Allie was going to join her on an overnight backpacking trip to the Jade Well, a pool of icy water beneath an 18-foot cliff. Perhaps she had decided to strangle her and figured it would be easiest to hide the body out in the deep, dark woods. They needed a third grown-up and drafted me. Off we went with 12 little kids on a 10-mile hike, walking in a cloud of mosquitoes. All I can say is thank God the children were deaf. Allie and Sarah cursed each other the whole way. When Allie glanced at her phone once, Sarah confiscated it. Allie would let branches snap back into her mother's face. The kids knew something was wrong and were getting more and more rattled. By the time we reached the Jade Well, the two of them were screaming at each other. Everyone was sunburnt and chewed to pieces. Sarah was furious at Allie for forgetting the bug spray back at the bus, and Allie was angry at Sarah for blaming the mistake on her, and I was ready to quit. They were standing near the edge of the cliff, and I just couldn't help myself. I took them both by the arm and dropped them over the side, right in their boots. And do you know what? They both came up laughing and spitting water at each other. The two of them were after me the rest of the hike. When they served out hot dogs, they passed me a nice fresh tampon and a roll. They opened the roof of my tent at 2 a.m. and doused me with cold water. They spritzed me with hairspray instead of suntan lotion. And you know what? It was good. The hike out was as happy as the hike in had been miserable. The kids took to protecting me from Ranger Sarah and Muskrat in training Allie. Nick especially. I think Nick decided it was his special responsibility to protect me from the mad women in his family. He was my bodyguard for the rest of the summer. There was one more overnight hike on the last weekend of camp. That was the night Sarah unzipped my tent. She only said one thing. Did I play my cards right? We had almost exactly a year together as a couple after that. She wanted to swim the Great Barrier Reef. I wish we had gone. I wish we had read books to each other. We had one weekend of sexy times in New York City while her father looked after the kids. I wish we'd had more. I wish we'd walked more. I wish we hadn't sat in front of the TV so much. It was nice. We cuddled. We laughed at Stephen Colbert and Seth Meyers. But it didn't make much in the way of memories. We did such ordinary, banal things. Ordered pizza and played Trivial Pursuit with her sister and her dad. Helped the kids with homework. We did dishes together more than we ever made love. What kind of life is that? Real life, Harper said. He had not looked at her once while he recounted the story of his courtship. Instead, he stared at his own shadow, which rose and fell in an almost tidal motion as the firelight pulsed in the open furnace. I spend more time thinking about the things I wish we had done than I do thinking about the things we did do. It was like we opened the perfect bottle of wine and each shared a sip, and then a clumsy waiter knocked the bottle to the floor before we got to have any more. The first time I saw the spore was at a luncheon presentation at the Boston Mycology Society, 3 months before Seattle. He didn't need to explain what he meant by Seattle. She knew he was talking about the Space Needle. A fellow named Hawkins, who just returned from Russia, gave a 40-minute PowerPoint on it. I don't know what scared me more, the photos or Hawkins himself. His mouth kept drying out. He drank half a pitcher of water while he was standing behind the podium. And he spoke in such a low voice you had to strain to hear what he was saying. We were all just catching little bits. Disease vectors, contagion points, cellular combustion. Meanwhile, he's flashing these horror movie pictures of charred corpses, all teeth and blackened meat. I can tell you, no one went back to the buffet for seconds, but the bar sure was busy. This guy, Hawkins, said in closing that while there were only 76 known deaths in Kamchatka, as a direct result of the spore, this had resulted in wildfires that had ended the lives of 530 other people. There had been almost $80 million of damage to urban areas, and the Russians had lost 4,300 acres of the richest timberland in the world. Hawkins said that 3 recent cases in Alaska suggested the pathogen might have a mode of transmission different than traditional viruses, and that further study was urgently required. Based on his math, 250,000 sick in the United States would easily lead to the deaths of more than 20 million people and would turn over 6 million acres into an ashtray. How much is that? About the size of Massachusetts. I have to say, he scared the hell out of us at the time, but in retrospect, he was far too conservative. I suppose his calculations didn't consider a social breakdown so severe there would be no one left to fight the fires. But you know, by dinner time, I had mostly quit thinking about it. It didn't take long to feel like just one more of this century's possible but unlikely apocalypses, like an epidemic of bird flu wiping out billions or an asteroid cracking the planet in half. You can't do anything about it, and it's happening to poor people on the other side of the world, and the kids need help with homework, so you just stop thinking about it. As much as I could stop. It was in the subject header of every email and the top 30 threads on every message board in the mycology community. There were webinars and conferences and a presidential committee. There was a report to the Senate. For a while I followed along out of academic interest. Also, you know me, Nurse Willows, how I do like to show off. What I learned about the spore gave me great cachet at backyard barbecues. I don't think it hit me on a human level that this thing was ever going to reach our backyard until Manitoba started burning and no one could put it out. That was about a month before the first Boston cases. But what good was it knowing? If it was a plague like other plagues, you'd hide. Head for the woods. Take the people you love, hole up somewhere, bolt the door, and wait for the infection to burn itself out. This, though, one person carrying the spore could start a fire that would wipe out half a state. Hiding in the woods would be like hiding in a match factory. At least cities have fire departments. I can tell you exactly when and how I caught it. I can tell you where we all were when we caught it, because of course we were together. We had a little party for Carol's 30th birthday at the very beginning of May. Sarah and I had just moved in together. We had a little pool, though it was so cold no one wanted to go in except Sarah. It wasn't much of a party. Just Tom and the kids and Sarah and Carol and myself, and a gluten-free cake for the birthday girl. Sarah and I often had late-night debates as to whether or not Carol had ever been laid. She had been engaged as a younger woman for 5 years to a very devout young man who everyone knew was a homosexual except, apparently, Carol. He was, I think, one of these decent, haunted young queers who are drawn to religion because they're hoping to pray the gay away. Sarah told me she didn't believe they had ever slept together, although they exchanged some very passionate emails. Carol dropped in on her fiancé by surprise, while the boy was doing a residency at a theological institute in New York, and discovered him in bed with a 19-year-old Cuban dance student. I asked Sarah once if she thought Carol herself might be gay, and she frowned about it for a long time, and finally said she thought Carol mostly just hated the idea of sex itself. She hated the idea of mess. Carol wanted love to be like a bar of soap, a purifying, hygienic scrub. She also said that Carol had full possession of their father, and that was the only man who had ever really mattered to her. Carol and Sarah could be quite wary of each other. When Sarah was teenage and pregnant, Carol sent her a scolding letter about breaking their father's heart and promised never to speak to her again. And she did, in fact, stop talking to her until Nick was born. Sarah made a place for her little sister back in her life, but things were always uneasy between them. Carol could compete for attention in a way that was so childish it was sort of funny. If Sarah was winning at Scrabble, Carol would put on a coughing fit, say she had come in contact with an allergen, and make her father drive her to the hospital. If Sarah and Tom started talking about Victor Hugo, Carol would insist Sarah couldn't really appreciate his novels because she hadn't read them in the original French. Sarah just laughed that sort of thing off. I think she felt too sorry for Carol to compete with her, and went out of her way to do nice things for her, like the birthday party. I was just building up the energy to go inside and get another beer when there was a big thud, like something heavy falling off a truck a long way off. Something so heavy it made the water shudder in the pool. Everyone glanced around, even Nick, who felt the vibration through his feet. Sarah stood in the shallow end, looking goose-bumpy and blue in the lips and very pretty, listening to hear if there was going to be something more. Nick saw it first, a black, oily tower of smoke coming from the end of the block. There was another thud and another, and then several close together, loud enough to shake the windows and make the silverware jump. Sirens wailed. Sarah said she thought it was the CVS drugstore on the corner and asked if I would look down the street and see. A lot of the neighbors had come out onto the sidewalks and were standing under the trees. The breeze turned and blew the smoke down the street. Oh, it stank, like roasting tires and foul eggs. I made my way down the block until I could see the CVS. One side was a roiling wall of red flame. A woman wept on the curb, using her T-shirt to mop up her tears. I had a hanky, so I handed it to her and asked if she was all right. She said she had never seen anyone die before. She told me a guy on a motorcycle had slid into the wire cabinet outside the drugstore, the one full of propane cans. They went off like a string of the world's largest firecrackers. Someone said it was a hell of an accident, and she said it wasn't just an accident. She said the guy was on fire even before he hit the propane tanks. She said it was like Ghost Rider. She said his helmet visor was up and there was a burning skull in there, flame and grinning teeth. I went back home, meaning to tell them all to go inside, not for any clear reason, just some vague apprehension. They were right where I left them, staring up at the smoke. They were standing together there in the snow. It had begun to snow, you see. Big goose-feather flakes of ash, falling in everyone's hair, falling in the birthday cake. A couple weeks later, Nick woke Sarah and me up to show us the stripe across his wrist. He didn't even ask what it was. He already knew. I found my first mark later that afternoon. Within 4 days, we were all scrawled with dragon scale. All of us, except Sarah. 8. All except Sarah, Harper asked. Story for another night, I think. You must miss her very much. His voice had tailed off and he stared across the room, into the open furnace, with blank, tranced eyes. He roused himself slowly, looked around, and smiled. She's still with me. Harper's pulse whumped in her throat. What? I talk to her almost every day. He narrowed his eyes to slits, peering intently into the flickering gloom, as if picturing her somewhere over there on the other side of the shed. I can always imagine just what she'd say to take the piss out of me. When I ask myself a question, it's her voice that answers. We are taught to think of personality as a singular private possession. All the ideas and beliefs and attitudes that make you, you. We are raised to believe them a set of files stored in the lockbox of the brain. Most people have no idea how much of themselves they store off-site. Your personality is not just a matter of what you know about yourself, but what others know about you. You are one person with your mother, and another with your lover, and yet another with your child. Those other people create you, finish you, as much as you create you. When you're gone, the ones you've left behind get to keep the same part of you they always had. She pursed her lips, exhaled a whistling breath. He was talking about memories, not ghosts. His gaze drifted back to the open hatch in the side of the furnace, and she thought, ask him about what you saw. Ask him about the face. Some instinct for caution prevented her. She thought if she pressed him now, he would play dumb, pretend he didn't know what she was talking about. And there were, after all, other, more important matters to press him on. You hardly touched your coffee, she said. It's gone cold. That is easily remedied, he said, and lifted his tin mug in his left hand. The gold hieroglyphics marking his dragon scale brightened and flashed. His hand became a chalice of flame. He rotated the mug slowly in his fingers, and the brew within began to steam. I wish there was a way to treat you for being such a shameless attention hog, she said. What? You think I'm showing off? This is nothing. Yesterday, stuck in my bed, dying as much from boredom as from my staved-in chest, I taught myself to fart smoke rings in 3 different colors. Now that was impressive. I'm glad someone is having fun with the end of the world. What makes you think the world is ending? He sounded genuinely surprised. Sure looks like the end of the world to me. 15 million people are infected. Maine is like Mordor now. A belt of ash and poison 100 miles wide. Southern California is even worse. Last I heard, SoCal was on fire from Escondido to Santa Maria. Shit, I knew I shouldn't have put off going to Universal Studios. What part of the end of the world is funny to you? All of it, especially the arrogant notion that the world will end just because humans might not make it through this century. We were never properly grateful for making it through the last century, as far as I'm concerned. Humanity is worse than flies. If even one dried nugget of offal survives the flames, we'll be swarming all over it, fighting about who owns it and selling the most fragrant chunks to the wealthy and the gullible. You're afraid it's the end times because we're surrounded by death and ruin. Nurse Willis, don't you know? Death and ruin is man's preferred ecosystem. Did you ever read about the bacterium that thrives in volcanoes, right on the edge of boiling rock? That's us. Humanity is a germ that thrives on the very edge of catastrophe. Who do you make these speeches to when I'm not around? He barked with laughter, then hunched over and grimaced. The idea of dying while laughing is more romantic in concept than reality. She turned to face him and crossed her legs like one preparing to meditate. Teach me to do what you can do.
What?
No, I can't. It's no good asking me how I do it. I don't understand it myself. I can't teach you because there's nothing to teach. God, you're a terrible liar. He put his bowl of oatmeal on the floor. That was dreadful, like eating paste. I would have been better scraping bugs off the bottom of rocks. What do you have in that bag of yours for painkillers? I need something powerful to knock me out. I haven't slept longer than 10 minutes at a time in the last 3 days. She rose and dug through the cloth shopping bag on the floor. She returned with 2 slippery plastic pouches of Advil. All I can spare for you. Wait at least 6 hours before you take the second. What in the name of the holy pussy drill is this? He cried. Advil? Just Advil? You're not a nurse. You're a third world torturer. I'm desperate is what I am, Mr. Rookwood. See that little grocery bag? There's a first aid kit in there. It contains over half of all the medical supplies I have to look after 150 people, including an elderly coma patient with a quarter-inch hole in his skull. He gave her a haggard, exhausted look. You need provisions. You have no idea. Plaster, morphine, antibiotics, a shitload of second skin burn pads, antihistamines, heart start paddles. Norma Held has rheumatoid arthritis, and on a cold morning can hardly open her hands. She needs Plaquenil. Michael is diabetic and 10 days from running out of insulin. Nelson Heinrich has high blood pressure and... Yes, yes, all right, I get the idea. Someone needs to rob a drugstore. Someone needs to rob an ambulance. Yes, I suppose that would do, wouldn't it? He gingerly touched his side. I'll need 4 or 5 days before I'm ready. No, better make it a week. I'm too sore and tired to do what needs doing right now. You won't be ready to go anywhere for 2 to 4 weeks. I doubt you could walk as far as the chapel in your current state. Oh, I'm not going. I'll send my phoenix. Now listen. There's a house. What does that mean, send a phoenix? As she spoke, Harper remembered the Marlboro man's pal Marty, half babbling. This giant fucking bird of flame, 30 feet from wingtip to wingtip, dive-bombed him. It dived so close the sandbags caught fire. Oh, another of my little goofs. A bit of fireworks to impress the natives, and fortunately something I can manage from long range. You and a few reliable hands will want to find a side street well away from camp. Verdun Avenue would be fine. That's across from the graveyard, and I happen to know number 10 is empty. Park in the driveway there, and... How do you know number 10 is empty? Sarah and I used to live there. 1 week from tonight, I want you to call 911. Use your cell phone. I think Ben held on to a collection of them. Tell emergency services your dear old dad is having a heart attack. When they ask, promise them you don't have dragon scale. Tell them you need an ambulance and wait. They won't send an ambulance without a police escort. Yes, but don't worry about that. That's what the Phoenix is for. My little light show. When they pull up out front, I'll see that everyone is chased away and you can scarper with all the supplies you need. I wish you could simply drive off with the ambulance, but it'll have LoJack or some other way to trace it. That's right. I don't want anyone hurt. The people in the ambulance are risking their lives to take care of others. No one will be hurt. I'll scare the pants off them, but that's all. I hate asking you for help. You always do this. You make things mysterious that don't have to be mysterious, because you like to keep everyone wondering about you. It's a cheap high. Don't deny me my little pleasures. You're going to get everything you want. There's no reason I can't have a little of what I want, too. I'm not getting everything. If I could do what you can do, I wouldn't need to beg for your help. Please, John... Can't you at least try to teach me? His gaze shifted past her to the furnace and back. Might as well ask a fish to teach you how to breathe underwater. Now go away. My side's hurt and I need to get some sleep. Don't come back without cigarettes. Did you try and teach her, Sarah? He seemed to shrink from her. For an instant there was so much shock and hurt in his eyes. It was as if she had slugged him in the ribs. No. Not me. Which was, she thought later, an odd sort of denial. He stretched out, turning onto his good side, so she was looking at the bony curve of his back. "Don't you have other people to look after? Give someone else the soothing balm of your bedside manner, Nurse Willows. I've had all I can take." She rose and put her shoes on, zipped herself into her parka, collected her bag. She stopped with her hand on the latch. "I spent 3 hours hiding in a cupboard today, with my ex not a dozen feet from me. I had 3 hours to listen to him talk about the things he's done to the sick, him and his new friends. 3 hours to listen to him talk about things he'd do to me if he had half a chance. From their point of view, we're the bad guys in this story. If he sees me again, he'll kill me. If he had the opportunity, he'd kill everyone in camp. And after he did it, he'd feel he had done a good day's work. In his mind, he's that guy in the cowboy hat from The Walking Dead, wiping out the zombies." To this, the fireman said nothing. She continued, "You saved me once. I will owe you for that the rest of my life, however long that happens to be. But if I die in the next couple of months, and you could have taught me how to be like you, how to protect myself, it'll be just the same as if you hid in the woods that night and let Jacob kill me." Bedsprings creaked uneasily. "I'm going to live to have this baby. If God can help me make it through the next 3 months, I'll pray. If Carol Story can keep me alive, I'll sing Kumbaya with her till my throat is hoarse. And if you can teach me something useful, Mr. Rookwood, I will even put up with your superior attitude and lack of manners and half-baked philosophy lectures. But don't imagine for a minute I'm going to drop it. You've got some keep-alive medicine. I want it." She opened the door. The wind wailed in a tone that was at once both terrifying and melodic. "One other thing. I didn't say I don't have any cigarettes. I said I don't have any cigarettes for you. And I won't until you put your teacher hat on and give me my first class in surviving spontaneous combustion. Until that day, my Galoise will stay in my shopping bag." As she shut the door, he began to yell. Harper learned a few new obscenities on her way back to the boat. Cuntswill was a good one. She would have to save that one for a special occasion. 9. Harper didn't know anyone was waiting for her on the dock until the boat bumped up against it and someone reached down to take the bow. "Help you out there, nurse?" Jamie Close offered a hand. It was as if the darkness itself were speaking. Harper could hardly make out Jamie's squat, chunky figure against the black swaying pines and the black turmoil of black clouds in a black sky. Someone else was with her, cleating the front of the boat. Allie. Harper knew her by her lithe, boyish frame and quick grace. Harper took Jamie's hand, then hesitated. The cloth sack of supplies was pushed in under the bench on which she sat, a canvas shopping tote containing the rum, cigarettes, instant coffee, and tea, among other things. What was hers belonged to all, according to the old rules of camp. But she was writing her own rules now. If liquor and smokes could buy the fireman's secrets, then camp would have to do without. Harper reached under the seat and plucked the first aid kit from the top of the sack. She rose, leaving the rest behind. She looked past Jamie, trying to catch Allie's eye, but the girl had already stood up from the cleat and turned her back. She was trembling. From rage, Harper thought, not the cold. She had her rifle over her shoulder. So did Jamie. "I'm sorry I didn't get back sooner, Allie. I understand if you're mad at me. If you're in any kind of trouble at all, I'll talk to Ben or Carol or whoever, and make them understand you bear no responsibility. But I don't see why you should be in trouble. I said I was going to check on the fireman and come back, and that's what I did, more or less." "You left out the part about going home first, though, didn't you, nurse?" Jamie said. So they knew she had taken a detour on her way to the fireman's island. She had kept to the trees on her way out of camp, but had looked back once and wondered if Michael, up in the church tower, was peering down at her. The eye in the steeple sees all the people. The infirmary was short on some critical supplies. Fortunately, I knew I could get what I needed from my own basement. The two fell in on either side of her. Harper was reminded of a police escort walking a prisoner into court. Jamie said, "That was all kinds of fortunate. You know what else was fortunate? You weren't clubbed to death with pool sticks. We was fortunate, too. We was fortunate they didn't follow your tracks into the woods and all the way back to camp. Oh, yeah, we seen them. The cremation crew that turned up right after you went in.